Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Lulu Garcia Navarro is the host of Weekend Edition Sunday on NPR. Lulu became the host in January. She comes to the show from Rio de Janeiro, where she was posted as NPR's international correspondent in South America. You might have heard her when she was one of the first reporters to enter Libya after the 2011 Arab Spring. Or perhaps it's her work reporting on Brazilian mothers caring for babies with microcephaly that you remember. Now you can hear her every weekend on NPR and right here on SDPB Radio. Lulu, thanks for making time for us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
All right, you've had some time to get settled. What are you liking about the new role?
Oh, so much fun. It really is. I get to, as I say, rediscover America through conversations every day. It's so exciting. It's a tumultuous time to be coming to the States. People are very divided. But I think that makes the responsibility and the also just, how interesting it is to get all these different viewpoints on the air so that people can stay informed and listen to, what other people that they may not necessarily come into contact with have to say.
Hosting a flagship weekend program on NPR means you probably have a lot of decisions to make throughout the week, and then those decisions, I'm guessing, change all over again. How do you make some of those choices about what the focus is going to be?
That's the hardest thing right now. It's not just me. We have a big staff of really talented producers, editors. There's a lot of thought that goes into putting this program on air. And we have so many meetings throughout the week that are about that, trying to decide, okay, this is the news today, but is that going to be the news on Sunday? Or this is the news today, but what is the conversation about this news that may have gotten lost in the blizzard of information? We're trying to be more reflective. We're trying to give people more context. Sunday is a sacred space, it is the time when people are either actually going to church or they're just taking a breather and they want to have a more relaxed, informative listening experience. And so I take that pretty seriously as a Sunday lover myself. lover of Sundays,
lover
rather.
Of
Let me
Sundays,
say
yes.
A lover of Sundays as opposed to a Sunday lover.
Right. We'll be clear with our language, as always. So are there certain values that you sort of come back to again and again when you talk about what, I'm intrigued by that, what part of the conversation has maybe gotten lost that we still need to have? Are there sort of, value structures that you come back to and ask yourself the same question again and again to get to that answer?
I think it's just the question that kind of lingers in your mind. When you see a news story and it's sort of breaking news, there is a moment when if you can just sit back, there's always these questions that people have in their minds, like, huh, how did that happen or why did that happen? For example, we're talking a lot today about the recent news to do with Russia and what the administration may or may not have known about contacts between administration officials and Russia. Mm. And so we're just talking about, okay, well, what about the leaks? Who's leaking this information? Why are they leaking it? What do we know about leaks? And so, that it's an interesting conversation possibly to have on a Sunday that's related to the news, but it's not news driven. It's more about informing our audience to give them the kinds of tools that they need to evaluate what's going on. There's so much going on right now. And I think people really need to just take a deep breath and try and think about, the information that we have and how we're going to process it.
What makes, with all this noise and all this news happening on all these different platforms, what makes really great radio for you right now? What creates that driveway moment? When we talked in my introduction about microcephaly, I remember you reporting from that and not being able to turn away from my radio whenever you came on with those conversations. Shift that to a host role, and what makes really great radio in that context?
Well, what makes, I think, really great radio is the same. It's the same ingredients. It's just really great voices, really great stories, people being able to have a narrative that resonates with the listener. And one of the things that I love about this role is just the power of talking to someone, asking good questions, and being able to listen to their answer. The reason I think that NPR's numbers, audience listening numbers, have gone up so dramatically is because I think that there is a value to just that intimacy of hearing someone's voice, giving them the time to explain themselves, giving them the space to sort of give context to something that's happened. And that's not only to do with news. That's to do with a really great novel or, you know, a musician that has a story about their album. I mean, it's just that there's so many different ways to tackle the human experience that I think can be uplifting and informative. And I think that that's, you know, what radio does. So for me, the conversations that I come back to again and again are just, you know, the ones that have just great stories.
On Valentine's Day, you tweeted, "I am more grateful than ever for NPR's thoughtful approach to journalism. I see every day the care that goes into what we do." A little Valentine's note for NPR in general. Is a thoughtful approach to journalism more important than ever, or are American journalists just doing what we do and what we've always done?
I think we're doing what we do and we've always done. Mm. I think there's more scrutiny now. There's more conversation about what it is that we do and how we do it. I think it's really important to be transparent now with the listener about how we get to the place that we do, how we make the decisions that we make. There is a desire on the part of the listener to be informed about the process of journalism. And I think that that is good and it's valuable.
Can you give me an example of that?
To have
that transparency and process? I'm curious.
Sure. You know, we're having discussions all the time with our listeners about how we sourced a particular story, who came to us with what, you know, information and why we decided to use it or not use it. Do we use the word liar? Do we not use the word liar? You know, these are now discussions where our managing editor is coming on our air to talk about that so that we respond to the concerns of the people, of our audiences. And I think that that's important. And I think that that's fair. You know, there are so many different sources of information now. There are so many questions about how we get the information that we get, and what are the decisions that go into making that assessment? And so, you know, I think it's a good moment to explain ourselves, and so people can see that there is so much care. There are so many thoughtful people discussing everything that we put out there. We don't just pick up a newspaper and regurgitate what's there. There's a lot of vetting. There's a lot of editing. We go out and we look to corroborate information. We do our own deep investigations and our own reporting. And so the news that you get from NPR is you know, news that has really gone through a lot of different eyeballs to make sure that it is fair and accurate.
Hmm. What makes a great radio host? What have you learned in the last month?
You tell me.
I'm hoping for some tips here, Lulu.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm too new at the game. Oh. I mean, I could tell you what I love about other radio hosts. I don't know. I'm still feeling my way in this job, which is kind of nerve-wracking to be doing, you know, when you have 5 million listeners. So, so for me, the thing that I want to do is, you know, ask the questions that our audience wants the answers to. Isn't that the thing that I'm doing ultimately? Yeah. I'm standing in for our listeners. And, you know, sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't. But the thing that I always keep very clear in my mind is that I am standing in for the people out there who, you know, can't sit in front of that politician to ask those questions, can't sit in front of the musician to ask those questions. I want to ask the questions that will be revealing and will be as informative to them as possible. So that's what we do. That's what the press is there for. You know, we're there to sit in the press room, to sit across from an elected official when our listeners can't. We're there for them.
Yeah, takes courage, a little bit of vulnerability, and a whole lot of preparation, I'm guessing, for you. Do you have the luxury of preparation, or are you always feeling like you wish you had some more time?
You always wish you had some more time. I mean, there's no question that at this, you know, it is incredibly important to be prepared. Again, luckily, we have really smart people on our staff that have been covering some of these issues for a long time and, you know, getting access to them and talking to them about what, you know, are the questions that are important to ask? What do we want out of any given interview is really kind of the key thing. But preparation is the most important thing, I am learning.
We better close with why the NPR IT department pays very close attention to the condition of your laptop, because that just sounds like a fun story. So tell me that history.
Yeah, it's on my bio page when, right? I started at NPR. Yeah, I've lost a series of laptops that have made me infamous. I lost one to a bullet in Baghdad because our car was strafed by gunfire. I know it sounds more fun than actually it was when it happened. But anyway,
right, fun is probably not the right word there.
Yeah. But it was always kind of fun when I would go into the IT department for my new laptop, and they'd be like, "That's her. That's her. Look, that's what she's not this mythical creature that just destroys laptops. She's a real person."
Don't complain. It's a bullet. Okay. So yeah, it's a good enough excuse, right?
If it's exactly. One of them drowned in a hurricane.
Oh my.
Because there was a flash flood and I lost my equipment, and and there was another one that kind of got blown to the wall in a bombing. So
wow.
I guess it shows. What it shows is that we get very close to the action.
Right.
We are always. Our microphone is very close to where things happen.
And now a very different role that you step into in the hosting chair. Do you have a vision for what that's going to look like going forward?
Yeah, first of all, this is a legacy show. So
right.
This is one of the flagship shows of NPR. But for me, I think the most important thing is to that we're listening to as many segments of the population that we can. It's something I always did in my reporting. I was always trying to go out and find people that we might not have heard from before. And I think that that is something that I want to bring to the host chair, and I am. I'm curious about, you know, stories that maybe you haven't heard before, and maybe about people that you haven't heard before. And the other thing is, what I think NPR does so well, and it's so important because we are a national network, is that everyone is hearing something almost at the same time. There's very few places anymore where you can sort of have a fireside chat where everyone's sitting, listening to the same thing at the same time and have a common point of reference. And, you know, it's such a valuable thing to be able to talk to different people from different parts of the country and sort of have other people connect to that. So, you know, that's the key.
Lulu Garcia Navarra is the host of Weekend Edition Sunday on NPR. You can hear that right here on South Dakota Public Radio. Lulu, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. People supporting and opposing a resolution encouraging law enforcement not to work with an Islamic group are taking the measure personally. A Senate committee yesterday considered a resolution that encourages government and law enforcement to avoid contact and outreach with the Council on American Islamic Relations, SDPB's Keely Butina is here. Keely, thanks for bringing this to the table.
Yeah, sure. Yesterday, opponents said that the resolution encourages hate. They pointed out that this Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, does not actually have a footprint in South Dakota. And there were some discrepancies that came out with numbers of resettling refugees or dates that the information was taken from and how that exactly matches terror threats. State Senator Stace Nelson is the prime sponsor of the measure, and despite those issues that came up in committee questions, Nelson says the resolution is based in fact.
One of the intelligence tools that is used is for organizations to infiltrate law enforcement, befriend law enforcement, get involved with law enforcement, and then able to co-op law enforcement. Not only co-op them, but also glean intelligence while they're working with law enforcement. None of the information that you've been presented with in opposition to this has refuted any of that. I haven't seen anything yet. A lot of the opposition to this is just merely saying that, a personal attack saying that this is an effort to squelch someone's freedom of religion. That's not the case. What this is a factual documentation of concern, of alerting our South Dakota law enforcement of what the FBI had already determined.
My name is Taniza Islam. I am an American Muslim civil rights immigration attorney in Sioux Falls and the director of the Collaborative Legal Incubator Program. I am here today on behalf of myself and my husband with a very heavy heart. As legislators in the state where my husband and I are raising our American Muslim family, have again targeted Muslims and a prominent Muslim organization to instill and perpetuate fear throughout South Dakota. I can find no other reason but to believe that this resolution is a smokescreen to target Muslims in South Dakota and our access to government and law enforcement agencies. Are you really asking law enforcement, fire departments, the DMV, health clinics, not to provide services to Muslims in South Dakota with this resolution?
My name is Migdad Mustafa. I'm originally from Sudan. I'm an American Muslim. I joined the United States Marine Corps and did two tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And almost lost my life a couple of times, and some of my friends didn't get to come back. And all of that was an effort to ensure that all Americans have the ability to enjoy freedom this country has to offer. I believe this resolution discriminates totally against Muslims.
My name is Brandy Sarles. I am currently a resident of Rapid City, South Dakota. I spent most of my childhood in this state. I spent over 5 years in the Marine Corps intelligence community as an Arabic linguist. SCR 7 makes a statement that makes me ashamed to be from South Dakota. It makes the statement that we believe in community only if you share our race, our religion, and our political views, regardless of any amendment inferring otherwise. It makes a statement that the values I was taught growing up in this state are all lies.
My name is Muhammad Sharif. I am a Muslim American of Libyan descent. I'm from Libya originally. I'm also the co-founder of the first Islamic center in the city of Sioux Falls 25 years ago. It is a platform for rising anti-Muslim sentiment. It is divisive, rhetoric, fear-mongering, sponsored by public officials. Having the legislature fought for this resolution and its amendment send a message to South Dakotans that it's okay to fear Muslims, and it will increase the levels of vandalism against our mosques and our community centers.
I am Reverend Dr. Larry Ort, an Episcopal priest from Brookings, South Dakota. SCR 7 is filled with misrepresentations, if not outright lies. It is nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to promote discrimination toward Muslims and Arab Americans. The South Dakota that I know and love is better than this. So is our country.
I'm Sister Lynn Marie Welbig. I'm a presentation sister from Sioux Falls. We have 1,000 foreign students at South Dakota State University, many of them who are from the Middle East, and you know what that means. They are appalled and fearful. The students from India are afraid. Who's going to be next on our list of unacceptable people in our state?
My name is Michael Saba, and I'm here representing just myself, although I am with Avera, and I formerly was with Sanford. Maybe I am here today because I was a hostage in Iraq in the first Iraq war, and it was Muslims in Iraq that helped to save my life and get me out of that country alive. So I have a special obligation, I believe, to point out that these are good people, that there are some people that claim to be Muslim that are condemned by mainstream Muslims, and I think we should take that into account.
Now, people who testified say they take this resolution personally. So does State Senator Stace Nelson.
Right. The Fulton lawmaker explains that here, and then State Senator Troy Heinert from Mission weighs in on Senate Concurrent Resolution 7.
Just got done hearing how all these people know for a fact that there's ulterior motives in this resolution. Never met them in my life. Don't know them. They never talked with me. They didn't ask anything about this. But they're projecting their opinions and their prejudice on me, which says a lot about them.
To read this resolution and to be able to sit here and listen to the testimony and see the good people who have come forward and who bravely have come forward in a time when they're not sure if they're safe to walk down the streets in our own state. So I thank them for coming today. That's very brave. We were offered suggestions from them. You know, this resolution could have been one line. Could have said, all South Dakotans reject terrorism. And I bet the same opponents today would have stood up and said, I agree with that statement. I come from a place that knows racism, that understands how bigotry can affect where you work, where you live, who you can love. And not too long ago, you couldn't even swim in a swimming pool in this state, except on Sundays if you were Native American. I don't want to see us go down that road again with things like this.
A law enforcement leader also testified that it's good policing to communicate and build trust with people of all religions, races, and backgrounds. So lawmakers on the Senate State Affairs Committee killed the resolution by a unanimous vote.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Keely Boltina. Keely, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
The election of President Donald Trump changed the conversation about oil infrastructure in America almost immediately. Today, construction on the pipeline at Dakota Access Pipeline is progressing. It could be operational in as little as 30 days. Protests against pipeline construction have drawn journalists, lawyers, and photographers to the region. Marissa Maltz is from Southern California. She's an independent filmmaker and artist who went to Standing Rock during December of last year, and there she made a new friend. In the Moment, producer Chris Loffrey caught up with the filmmaker when she was in South Dakota recently.
You went to Standing Rock as an independent filmmaker and an artist. What were your expectations?
Well, firstly, I actually tried to go out there with few expectations because I really wanted to educate myself on what was actually happening at Standing Rock because there was sort of very little information that I could find other than what was being posted by friends and small articles that people were coming up with at that time. The media wasn't covering it that much up until I went in December. So I was trying to just educate myself as to what was going on and also just help out in any way that I could. But I mostly just wanted to sort of get an understanding.
Let's talk about the real-life experience once you got there.
I thought that I would end up meeting and talking with a lot of different people, and I ended up sort of very quickly meeting within the first couple hours that I was there. I ended up meeting this girl, Diamond, and we ended up just getting along and kind of hanging out, and she was like, you can just come with me and sort of see what my day's like and help out with whatever I'm doing.
My name is Diamond J. Stans. I'm from Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. I've been up here since this all began.
And so my experience actually ended up to be more through what this teenager was doing at Standing Rock, which was actually mostly just hanging out and helping on small things. And so the experience was actually more through the lens of what she was experiencing. Like we ended up just kind of like hanging out in this van one night and driving around for like 2 or 3 hours and like, which was actually sort of similar to how I used to hang out in high school. I actually ended up having like a really enjoyable and fun experience with her.
Tell us a little bit more about Diamond. Tell us a couple more things that you learned about her.
Well, so at first, like we were having like such a fun time, and I think I was genuinely having a nice time because it was reminding me of like of being in high school, and like her jokes were really similar to like the sort of jokes like I used to think was funny and still think are funny from high school. And she, you know, was like talking to me about the music that she likes listening to and like the sort of things that she and her friends do. And then once we started to sort of, I'm not sure how it started to get into sort of deeper issues, but I guess we just started talking about Standing Rock and the issues there and kind of started talking about what her life was like a bit more. And I think because we were having such a pleasant time, the shock of what her actual life was like really caught me a bit off guard. And she also was so cool about it, which also caught me really off guard. Like, she talked about the things that she goes through on a daily basis, like in conversation in such a sort of cool way, that I was just very struck.
After listening to some audio that you provided us, I was really literally taken by surprise by something that Diamond said.
Being out here, like, brings comfort to me. Like I don't have to worry about anything else. But then on the other hand, I do have to worry about some things, like worrying about the DAPL workers getting through. You know, if we do get thrown in jail, you know, we see it as a good thing, and, you know, like, we don't even make a fuss about it. Like, yeah, we went to jail, but, you know, that's kind of what most of us youth are here for.
So that surprises me that someone, of her age sounds that calm and is okay with everything she's experiencing.
Well, I think one of the things that I was most taken aback by is that... I think one of the things that struck me the most was that the life that she had at Standing Rock was clearly a very happy place for her. She was very happy being there, and I think so were her friends that were her age. And I think part of that is that, you know, for the first time, she was experiencing white people being kind to her, and there was food to eat consistently and clothes available, and it sort of was this community that was very positive, which in comparison back to the life on her reservation, which is just border to border with Standing Rock, the Cheyenne River Reservation, that's not what her life is like at home. Like, I don't think white people had never been kind to her before, and I don't think she even knew that that was something that existed or was possible. And she never has food at home, and I think that the environment that Standing Rock provided was one that was positive and hopeful, and I think that that's really important to take away from that, if that makes sense. And I think that she, I don't know. I think that's the one thing that sort of, like, that I left thinking about the most was that, like, that, like, for that to be such a positive experience, like, what her life must be like at home. Like, I don't know.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Our guest today is Marissa Maltz, independent filmmaker and artist from Los Angeles, spent some time on the Standing Rock Reservation. And finally, I mean, I can really sense the genuineness in your voice and how this experience changed your life in a sense. So I'll ask you finally, Marissa, and I appreciate your time today, would you approach things in a completely different way if there is a next time?
That's a hard question to answer, because I think my lack of knowledge about it was what sort of helped me to go in there with kind of, like, open eyes, or my lack of knowledge about it, like, allowed me to sort of be in an experience where I was quite shocked by Diamond's words, and allowed us to have this sort of very natural friendship and relationship that kind of blossomed over the course of a couple days and then became very genuine in what she sort of expressed to me. And I think if I would have gone in there, you know, differently with some kind of goal or something, I don't know if I would have been able to have the same sort of genuine experience that I had with her, if that makes sense. And I do think there were probably a lot of people at Standing Rock going in there to try and and you know, get films or audio or certain things like out of it. And I really didn't know what to expect. And so I wasn't, and I think that helped to sort of get a really sort of powerful understanding of what was happening.
Marissa Maltz, independent filmmaker, an artist from Los Angeles, California. Thank you so much for your courage to go to the Standing Rock. And of course, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's In the Moment producer Chris Loffrey. He was talking with filmmaker Marissa Maltz. And now Nate Weck is one of SDPB's digital content strategists. He joins us this week with a look at state high school wrestling, specifically Sturgis. Is that right, Nate?
Yeah, that's correct. How you doing, Laurie?
I'm doing all right. I'm here broadcasting live from the University of Sioux Falls studios, and Nate is in Vermilion at the University of South Dakota. So how's the weather down there, Nate?
Really good.
Another
for February.
Beautiful day.
Yes, yes. It's perfect. Let's keep this going. I like it a lot. I like not having to wear a winter coat into the building. Sweatshirts will do just fine for me.
I love it. All right, so let's celebrate the Sturgis wrestling team after celebrating the weather.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting program. You know, they're out West River, and some of these really, really good wrestling programs that you'll find throughout South Dakota are in some of the areas where you maybe wouldn't expect. Like, you don't have to go to a Sioux Falls to find a really good wrestling program. You know, just 30 miles south of Sioux Falls in Canton, they have a very good Class B wrestling program. And out west in the town of Sturgis, Sturgis Brown High School, a very good wrestling program in that Class A. And the thing that's kind of separates Sturgis, and the reason that we chose to, in a sense, highlight the Sturgis wrestling program, is because of the success that they've had over the past two decades with their coach, Steve Kessler. Because in the 22 years that he was head coach of Sturgis Brown, they brought home a championship at the state event. So that right there is absolutely huge. And it kind of goes to show the depth that the program has had at times. And every year when they're getting to that state meet, you know, people are leaving that event and they've heard the name Sturgis Brown High School on the podium at some point. So I think, you know, they're definitely a team that everybody knows about. If you're a high school wrestling fan in South Dakota, I'm sure you know exactly what Sturgis is all about and what they've been about the last two decades. And it's because they've consistently coached their players that hard work is a necessity if you want to succeed. And it's another thing that I thought that Coach Kessler spoke on when he talked to us was, it's not just the individuals who are getting first place and getting a state title. It comes back to the individuals as well. Even the ones that are placing seventh and standing on the podium, it's just as big a deal for them to have that success, because we're all working together to achieve the same goal. And
so, Nate, is it, you know, we talked a little bit about geography and the success of the program in Canton, success of a program in Sturgis. Is it really come down to the coach, or are there other things that sort of support that kind of legacy?
I think it comes down to, you got to have good coaching, obviously. But I think another thing that Kessler talked about is just the community of Sturgis, because there's, you know, Steve Kessler was a high school wrestler, and he wrestled with kids who are now parents of the kids that he is helping teach. So, I mean, there's also a reputation, I think. You know, some of these kids just grow up and they're in a wrestling family and they want to wrestle because that's what their dad did and their grandfather did. So it's, you know, I think part of it has to do with legacy. And I think when you have a program that has established itself and you have, and it's such a big deal in the community of Sturgis, it's really easy for kids to say, oh, I want to go into wrestling. I want to be a high school wrestler. I want to be a state champion. That's what I want to do. I think it's easy to do that because the culture of the community is so involved in it.
Nate, does it attract students? Can they open enroll in Sturgis like they can in a city like Sioux Falls? Are they pulling kids from Custer or Hill City or other places to the Sturgis program? Do you know?
You know, that's a good question, Laurie. I don't know the answer to it. What I do know is that when Kessler started coaching over 22, 23 years ago, he had about 51 to 55 kids, and now that number's kind of shrunk to the mid-30s. Mm-hmm. As for open enrollment, I would assume that it's definitely, you know, if, you know, either
it'd be a whopper of a commute.
It would be a whopper.
It's a different commute.
Correct. But I think, so, you know, if there's a kid that's passionate enough about it, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see it, because it's such an addicting program to want to be a part of, I think.
All right. We're going to hear from Coach Steve.
Yes, Coach Steve, he talks a lot about kind of the philosophy that they have at Sturgis Brown for all of their athletes.
Well, you need to put in your time, put in your work, and earn your time. Your time will come. You know, some people are lucky enough that they make varsity as a freshman and they go all the way through. But, you know, some kids only get one chance. And you just need to keep those kids with a good JV schedule to keep them motivated to be around, which we do have a good JV schedule. Two is that, you know, we educate them that not everybody gets 4 years on varsity and you need to wait your turn, but put in your time, because your time comes. When your time comes, then you need to step in and be ready to perform at a high level for us. And so it's just a lot of individual talk with them and tell them that their time's coming, and just keep working hard, and hard work, you know, will solve everything. If you just put in the time, you'll get your chance.
Nate, what I love about that is managing the expectations on top of the hard work, letting these kids know they might have to wait for their chance, but they better be ready when it arrives.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the kids understand that because of, like I said, the history of the program. You know, this program's been a work in progress for the last two decades. So they're, you know, I think you, as a freshman, you come in the door and there's those senior leaders, there's those varsity leaders that they look up to. And then, you know, but just like it is in college when graduation hits and it's time to walk over the podium and go to the next chapter of your life, it's time for the next person, next man up philosophy of, okay, who's going to step up and be a leader. And I also liked, Lori, the part where he talked about how hard work will solve anything. You know, if you want something bad enough, you work your butt off and you can achieve it. I think that's really important too, because, you know, there's a lot of people who work hard, but sometimes you need that little extra push if you want to succeed and reach the goals or the expectations. And certainly with the Sturgis wrestling program, the expectations are obviously high on an annual basis. There's a lot of support from the community revolving around the program. So, you know, if you're a kid and you're in that system, you know, why wouldn't you want to work hard? Because you want to live up to those expectations that have been laid down before you.
All right, Nate, let's finish up. You got a digital short on this project. People can find it on Facebook. Is that right?
Yep. Finishing up the video today. We'll have it shared out on our South Dakota Public Broadcasting Sports Facebook page. That's SDPB Sports. You can just search it on Facebook. Give us a like, and this video will be on this evening. So, yeah.
Right.
And you'll be able to hear a lot more from Coach Kessler on all of the philosophies and stuff like that for Sturgis Brown High School.
I want to avoid the cliche of saying what a lesson these kids will take into the rest of their lives, but what a lesson these kids will take into the rest of their lives. Nate Weck, thanks so much. And state wrestling next Friday begins, so we'll be following you there.
All right. Thanks, Lori. Keep warm.
And welcome back to In the Moment. You can find Kevin Wooster's blog at sdpb.org/Wooster. It's called On the Other Hand. If you don't know how to spell Wooster, it's got one O. Kevin joins us on Thursdays with news from the state and from the blogosphere. Kevin Wooster, welcome back to In the Moment.
It's great to be back from a Rapid City with a temperature of 65 degrees and rising.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Fishing. You're out fishing this week.
I fished yesterday, and not long after I get off the phone here, I'll be heading up somewhere in the Silver City area to fish for a while today.
Well, we appreciate you taking time for us.
I love taking time for you.
All right, let's start with what many blog posts you can find. We don't always have a chance to get to all of them, so make sure go online to sdpb.org/Wooster. Let's start with EB5 scandal, because that's something that folks are writing into newspapers about, Kevin, about the probation for Yope Bolin.
They sure are, and there's actually been a couple of them lately here in the Rapid City Journal, and I'm sure they're ending up in newspapers all across the state where letter writer took a pretty good shot at Marty Jackley, saying that you know, with the deal, I guess you could call it the negotiated deal, a plea bargain that that Yope got on EB-5, his involvement and the allegations and charges against him, that was saying that he must have a good lawyer. The letter writer said, "Unfortunately, we don't, or I wish we did." And of course, you can imagine Jackley took that kind of personally,
right?
And it's been a big issue for him. So I took the letter, which, you know, one of the weaknesses of letters are they don't always. It's not like somebody's reporting, and newspapers used to have more staff and more time to try and challenge letters writers that maybe didn't have their facts right. And there was some things wrong in this one that Jackley pointed out in his response on my blog. The general criticism remains that Bowen still got a pretty good deal.
People are dissatisfied with probation, but he didn't pocket $167,000. $165,000 is what the letter was sort of saying he got away with, but that's inaccurate.
Yeah, and that was apparently some reporting. And, you know, we, as a reporter, I know that we sometimes make mistakes in interpreting things, and apparently that was corrected. But the letter writer either didn't see the correction or didn't acknowledge the correction, and so it ended up in the paper that way. And even Jackley would argue, as I said in my blog, that he probably did get a better deal than Jackley would have liked him to see. And Jackley's argument is that that's what the law and the sentencing stipulations pretty much dictated, and that's why he has a bill in the legislature that would make that, the misuse of public funding or a public account the potential for a felony, that and also the potential for actual jail time or prison time that doesn't exist now in the law, he says.
So his hands are tied somewhat. So first, get the facts right, he says, and then second, he says, yeah, I'm not satisfied either, but it was all I could do.
Yeah, and I think some would argue that maybe there was more that could have been done on this. You know, and these are, I'll probably be writing something on the blog here before too long on this issue and how it might affect Jackley's run for governor, whether this is an issue that Kristi Noem would bring up or some other candidate in the campaign would bring up. And would this issue play well against him? Because there was a follow-up letter to the editor that wasn't in my blog that I just saw yesterday, I think, and where somebody said, make sure when he runs for governor, you bring this up and challenge him with it. And I'm sure somebody will. I imagine they'll bring this up. I would guess they'll bring the Gear Up scandal and human tragedy there, that whole issue up. And something I'll probably look at is how big could this be in Jackley's campaign for governor.
And then on the blog itself, you can comment on it, and someone does, and talks about the four charges that Attorney General Marty Jackley dismissed. Is that accurate? Did he dismiss four charges?
Well, the question is, how much, again, do you get if you're going to strike a plea bargain? And
sure.
I'm sure that the part of the deal with Yope Bowen pleading innocent in the first place, or not guilty in the first place, was to get to the point of being able to plea bargain away. And one of the things he plea bargained away in agreeing to this is that he will provide information in the future on this case. And Jackley would argue that, you know, part of the process is you give something up to get something. And he got a guilty plea, and he got the guy that hadn't said anything and may have useful information to agree that he would provide that information if called upon. So you can always argue about, that whether that's a good thing. Is a plea bargain a good thing to agree with? Jackley's argument was he got the best he could get under the law as it stands now, and part of what he gets is perhaps more information from Bowen in the future.
So political consequences, sort of a big question mark right now for that. And this is sort of something proponents of Initiated Measure 22 have brought up again and again as one of the reasons that people don't have the same level of trust of state government that they did before. They thought this should have been caught sooner and handled differently. So it's all part of the same conversation.
Yeah, definitely part of the same conversation. Now, how much would IM-22, the way it was written last fall, have affected either Gear Up EB-5? You can have that debate. I think you guys touched on that with Junkies yesterday. I was traveling.
Yeah.
with my rod in hand, but I was in the pickup sometimes, so I caught what I could have. And that discussion is, how much is this going to affect Jack Lee? How much is it going to affect any of the candidates that voted against, to negate that voter decision last fall? And I guess I think there was a yawn involved, maybe, or a whole
right,
heart involved.
Jonathan Ellis was yawning at the indignity. And then I misquoted him on Twitter. I wrote it down on a board, and I wrote it down incorrectly. So I had to go back and fix it. I misquoted Jonathan Ellis. It's just such a mess. But it was a yawn at the indignation.
I think that's a good thing for reporters to end up being misquoted once in a while ourselves. That's good. But I would tell you that I don't know that I would yawn at it, because I think there is sincere indignation, and I think there is danger in negating a voter decision. I would argue, and I ended up voted against IM-22. I liked a lot about it, but I think I understood it probably better, and I'm maybe going on a limb here, than some voters. And I didn't completely understand its impacts when I voted for it. There was a lot of stuff to understand. And I think what the Republicans are doing here is a pretty good job of covering their tracks on this by the legislation they're passing. And obviously, I'll be writing something about that before too long. And also, from a sincerity standpoint, they're also dealing with some of the issues raised by IM-22. So it's an interesting move on their part. And how much will Jack Lee get caught in all the middle of this? And the other question is, I'm going to be interested to see, how much is Christine Ohm, a woman who's not afraid of a fight, how much is she going to bring in? And if she does, what would the Republican establishment say about that if she brings up government corruption in her campaign against Jack Lee?
Interesting. Now, in our second hour, Kevin, we're going to have a whole conversation about ethics, because it does seem to be the thing that everybody's talking about right now.
It should be. I mean, it really should be. That I think some of the allegations about Republican corruption and the good old boy system that exists are overblown. But I think when you get in a situation as we have, in the last decade especially, with so much total control by one party, it is natural that it gives rise to suspicion. Then when you have an EB-5, when you have a gear up, come up, whether or not they are directly tied to that or not, whether or not they would have happened even if there was more Democratic balance, people are inclined to think, well, now I know why this all happens. And we still have a ways to go in ethic law and ethic rule in this state, and I hope we're heading in that direction.
And in that second hour, we're going to talk to a whole panel of experts about for the hour, what does it mean when we talk about ethics? What are our expectations? How do we hold ourselves and others accountable for ethical behavior? How do we create a culture of integrity? Kevin, what do you want me to ask? What do you want to know?
Well, I always argue that the first step in ethics is transparency. Mm-hmm. And that the biggest part of any ethics framework is to make it transparent and to make the system as transparent as it can. And we've got to certainly have a ways to go in transparency in South Dakota, in state government, and the processes involved. I think Governor Dugard, in my opinion, he's been open to that and willing to look at improving the transparency. And then once you make it transparent, then you've got a better idea of what's actually going on. And that's
all right.
Where I would start.
We'll start there. Kevin Wooster,
okay.
We'll see you next week. Happy fishing.